If you were to die today, would you go to heaven or hell? It's exactly this binary thinking that has scared a lot of people into choosing Jesus. Not because of who Jesus is and what he represents on this earth, but because we're actually afraid to go to the bad place. And that's exactly what I want to talk about today. What is hell? What does the Bible have to say about hell? And how can we better think about this idea and concept in our world today? This is Whiskey in the Writings, a place for the skeptic, the seeker, those who still believe, but maybe just not like they used to. A place where you can wrestle honestly and openly about the questions you've been too afraid to ask, all while sipping on some great bourbon. My name is Joe Oliver. I'm your host. Thanks for watching. Let's get into it. Hey everybody, thank you for joining me on Whiskey in the Writings. We have got a great episode for you today. We're going to be talking about the concept of hell, all while drinking some bourbon, having some great conversation about something that we just take for granted in our world today. I'm drinking Russell's Reserve 10 Year. This is a fantastic Kentucky straight bourbon that is super delicious. It's got hints of vanilla in it. Just makes it super flavorful, and I love to drink this. This is one of my favorite bourbons to drink neat, actually. A lot of times I'll put, ice. A lot of people do that. I'll put some Diet Coke in it sometimes. But when I'm thinking of drinking neat, this is one of my top favorites. And so if you've never tried Russell's Reserve, the 10-year, I encourage you to go pick it up. And whatever you have in front of you, cheers, drink responsibly, and we're going to talk about this. Concept of hell is what we're looking at today. And the reason why I'm doing a video on hell is actually, it's something I've been wanting to make a video about, to talk about my different thoughts on hell and what I think the Bible's actually trying to offer us in this conversation of hell. But the reason why I'm doing it now, and the reason why I've chosen to do it now, is a couple things. So if you're here in the Treasure Valley, Boise, Meridian, Nampa, that kind of general area, Eagle, we host a local meetup every other week. My wife and I do, along with some other leaders, friends of ours, called Barstool Theology, where we get together and we allow conversation to exist where we can ask the tough questions and wrestle with them together in a group of people. And it's a really great, great get together. We hang out at Sockeye Brewing, and it's, you've seen me wear Sockeye merch before. We love Sockeye. And Josh, if you're watching, hey, shout out to you. But all that to say, we meet at Sockeye, and we have these great conversations. And our topic this past week was on hell. And what is it? What does the Bible have to say about it? So that was our topic. Well, so we post this information of what we're talking about a week and a half before we actually have the meetup. And it's all curated by the group. So the group gets to decide what we talk about. It's all voted on. It's a really fun process. But all that to say, you can go to our website, Stories of Tove, or barstooltheology.org, and you can see more information about that. I say all of that to say one of our watchers of Whiskey in the Writings noticed that on our Instagram for Barstool Theology that we were having this conversation, and they emailed me and asked that we would cover this topic. So this is for our viewer asking that we cover this because they don't live in the area and they couldn't participate in the conversation of Barstool Theology, and they wanted me to do a video about it. So that's what we're doing. I'm responding to someone reaching out directly saying, hey, would you talk about this? Which is also an invitation. If there's something you want me to share or talk about, I would love to hear from you. You can write to us at whiskeyintherewritings @gmail.com, and we will get back to you and maybe cover something that you're asking us to watch. So that's why we're talking about hell. And we had a great discussion this past week when we met, and it was really lively and encouraging and exciting. And it just made me want to make a video with the encouragement of our viewers to talk about this idea of hell. And I want to kind of give some background a little bit to my experience with this topic and how I've come to understand it. And then we'll get into some more of the theological points of views on it. So just to kind of open up, what my background on the topic of hell is has been shaped a lot from culture, meaning I didn't grow up a Christian. And so I didn't have the framework that many people do of a heaven, hell dichotomy, right? These binary ways of thinking. And so I didn't have those categories. My understanding of hell actually came from Tom and Jerry. growing up watching cartoons, Looney Tunes, right? So what happens with in the cartoons when they die? They descend down into a fiery location by which these little demons and a devil with a mustache and a pitchfork and horns is sitting there, and they're tormenting people. One of the most traumatic examples of hell that just set me through nightmares. Do you remember the movie Legend? It's this really old movie. It has Tom Cruise. I think it's Tom Cruise's very first movie that he was ever in. It's called Legend. And so you should YouTube it, look it up. Super scary, but they have a depiction of the devil in that movie. And as a kid, again, I didn't grow up a Christian, so these kinds of movies were totally in range for me to watch. And why my parents let me watch it, I can ask them that question another day. But I remember watching this, and it was so scary. It was like he was like this Minotaur. I think that's the horse human Greek, you know, animal human thing. Anyway, look up the pictures. It was super freaky. I haven't seen it in decades, so who knows if it would scare me today? Probably would, but because I'm afraid of those kinds of movies to begin with. But I remember that scene when they descend into his realm and there's demons and the devil. I mean, it was freaky. So that was my concept of the fear. Right. So it was a bit comical that kind of put categories in my brain of like when you die, your soul goes down to this place, like in the cartoons, you know, the white soul floats down and then they're entrapped and tortured. And then later on is more vivid and more realistic depictions of the devil were shown on screen. Those kind of created categories for me to think about hell. Even though I wasn't spiritual in any way. So when I came into Christianity, there was a narrative and continues to this day that says, if you believe in Jesus and you do the right things, you'll go to be with him. But if you don't believe in Jesus and you do the wrong things, you'll go to be with the devil. And in my brain, like hell, the devil was everything that I saw in the movies, all the cartoons that I saw. And it seemed that the more I read the Bible, it affirmed that point of view. It was like, well, Jesus talks about flames and Jesus talks about a fiery existence. And the Old Testament seems to be pointing to some of those things. And so what I saw in the movies must be true. And I lived that way for a good portion of my Christian life, that is what happens. If I don't do the right things, or if I'm caught in sin, i.e. a lie, a temptation, a lust, whatever, if I get busted with that in my brain, when I die, I'll go to the bad place. And so my existence in Christianity began to be this thing where I was like managing morality. I was trying to manage my sin. And I am so thankful I have offloaded that weight and that burden, you know? And maybe you're watching and you're in that place where you're still trying to manage your own morality and your own sin management and trying to just stay away from the bad things as best you can. And, you know, so you don't get busted when you die. And then, oh, I guess I sinned and now I'm going to the bad place. And if that's where you're at, I just want to offer you hope that there is a way forward that can release you of that burden. Remember, If you're not familiar, Jesus offered, he said, hey, my yoke is easy, my burden is light. What Jesus is offering to us is that the way of Jesus should not be a burden to us, that his way actually brings life and life more abundant. And so if your relationship to Jesus feels more like a burden and you feel constant shame of what you're not enough in, I want to invite you to offload that and begin to onboard what Jesus is inviting you into. And if you're wondering what that is, I'll link to some of those videos at the end of this video that you can go check out that might help offer you a way forward in the way that you think about these things. So here I was trying to understand like sin management. And I began to grow in these areas and begin to learn and research as I developed in my understanding of the biblical narrative and the biblical world. And I want to offer you some ways of thinking that might help categorize these conversations a bit better for you. And then at the end, let you make some conclusions on your own. So I don't want to say this is what it is. I want to say, here's how I have, in my study, have read and the conclusions I've come to, and then let you see if you can draw out your own conclusions. But there are some things that we need to understand when we think of hell, because you open up your Bible and you start reading, you're gonna read the word hell. But what does that mean? And is the way that the Bible talks about that word mean the same thing that we mean when we use it today? That's the big question, right? The way I say hell or think of hell, and the way I grew up thinking about it, whether it was the devil in the movie Legend or Tom and Jerry in Looney Tunes, that hell, that place, is that the way I'm using it? Is that the way that the biblical authors used it? My opening here is to say no. No. We have lost in translation the ability to understand the nuance that this word, this concept of hell, where it even comes from and where it begins and what it means. And so let's unpack that here on this video. That's my big setup for where I'm at, where I'm going, and where I hope to lead in this video on hell. So let's begin with the scriptures or the writings. We got our bourbon, we got our writings. Two favorite things: to drink some bourbon and have a conversation about the writings of the Bible. This is going to be a great morning, midday, or afternoon, wherever you're at. I hope this is helpful to you. So I have some notes over here on my computer because there's just too much that I want to make sure I say that's in here that I don't want to miss. And so I have a few notes here. The first thing I want to do is set certain categories in our brain, okay? Certain understandings of the different eras of thought on this topic. And what I mean eras is that there are periods of times that you can group biblical studies in that each era has a different understanding of this topic. So let's go to the very beginning. The first era in biblical history is Proto-Judaism. Judaism that is ancient. It's a period of time that we might say the Genesis all the way up to the destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonian Empire or the Assyrian Empire, which was Israel and then Judah eventually being conquered because they were divided kingdoms, conquered by Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians. So these kinds of two nations, the Assyrians and the Babylonians, they play a crucial role in dividing certain ways of thinking in Jewish thought. So the first part is going to be ancient Judaism, Proto-Judaism, and its point of view on death and hell is maybe we would say. That's not the word they're going to use, and we'll talk about that in a second. In Proto-Judaism, you have a concept of what happens when you die and where you go when you die. And in Proto-Judaism, which is the earliest form of Judaism before what we know of it today, the concept that was communicated in our, what we call our Old Testament, is called Sheol. This is a dark, it's a silent, it's a cut off from life existence. And so anytime you have in the writings that date before the destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonian Empire, anything before that, the concept and idea of death was Sheol. It was a silent, dark, like a resting place. It was inevitable. Everyone went to Sheol. So this is different, right? In the way we think of hell, the opposite of hell would be heaven. So good people go to heaven, bad people go to hell, as we like to categorize it. But in Proto-Judaism, there was no concept of a separate place where you go. Good people go here, bad people go here. Everyone went to Sheol when you died. This was inevitable for any type of human. When you die, you will go to Sheol. There is no worship in Sheol. There is no remembrance in Sheol. It is the end. It is final. It is rest in different ways of Jewish thought. And so there are some key verses to help us see how this is played out in the Old Testament. I'm going to go through a couple of them. So in the writing Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 10, and I'm using the NET version, it says, "Whatever you find to do with your hands, do it with all your might, for there is no work or planning or knowledge or wisdom in the grave." And so it says in the grave, but if you look at the Hebrew word for the English word grave in this point, it's Sheol. So it's, there's no work, there's no planning, there's no knowledge, there's no wisdom in Sheol, the place where you will eventually go. So the writer of Ecclesiastes is saying, look, you know, whatever you do on this life, get the most out of it. Because when you die and you go to Sheol, there is no work, there's no knowledge, there's no wisdom, there's no, it's over, it's done. You're at rest. Everyone will go there. In Psalm 139, verse 8, it's this concept of there is no escape of God's awareness in Sheol. So even though you are in rest, God is still somehow in that space as well. Because it says, if I were to ascend to heaven, you would be there. If I were to sprawl out in Sheol, or which is to say to descend into, to sprawl out to, another way you could say that is to descend into Sheol, right? The depth, there you would be. And so there's this idea that even though Sheol is a place of rest, of no knowledge, no wisdom, as Ecclesiastes says it, that God, because of who he is, he's everywhere, that you can't escape God no matter where you go, not even in Sheol, which is an interesting point of view in Proto-Judaism, that even in Sheol, God's presence is still there. That's how they thought. This is ancient Proto-Judaism. How about Psalms chapter 6, verse 5, where it depicts Sheol as a place of silence? It says, "For no one remembers you in the realm of death in Sheol. Who gives you thanks?" So it's this idea that there's not even worship, maybe, in Sheol. It is a quiet, restful place. The last place I want to look at is in Job. And I'll turn there in my print Bible, because I want to kind of get the wholeness of what's being said here. But in Job, you have this point in Job's life after all of the tragedy that has come upon him. He is reflecting on his life and he's actually saying, maybe I should have just died at birth. So Job chapter 3, he's sitting in regret and despair and a place where he is saying, maybe I just shouldn't even be born. Maybe I should have just died. So he's talking about just moving on from this life. And in verse 13, he starts with this. For now, I would be lying down and would be quiet. I would be asleep and then at peace with kings and counselors of the earth who build for themselves places now desolate, or with princes who possessed gold, who filled their palaces with silver. Or why was I not buried like a stillborn infant, like infants who have never seen the light? There the wicked cease from turmoil, and there the weary are at rest. There the prisoners relax together. They do not hear the voice of the oppressor. So in the longing of Job, after all of the tragedy he's experienced, he's saying, I just want to go to the place, Sheol, death, where I can just be at rest, where the kings are, where the princes are, where the slaves are, where I can be, where we're all equal on equal footing, and we're free from the burdens and the turmoils and the sadness of this life. Super depressing for Job, and considering what he had gone through, understandable. But the point here I'm talking about is that in Proto-Judaism, in ancient Judaism, the idea of the afterlife was one of darkness, rest, peace, silence. It was a underworld where everyone goes eventually, and that's it. That's it. There is no like go to heaven when I die language in Proto-Judaism. It is all about this final end. So super interesting. And when you examine the literature that predates the destruction of the temple by the Babylonian Empire, that you get depicted in the prophets and in the later writings, this is all the narrative and the language. Okay, so right out of the gate, the first era of Judaism had no concept of going to heaven when you die. It was everyone goes to Sheol, good, bad. It's silent, it's peace, it's rest. These were the ideas that were floating around. They just didn't have language or words for the concepts that we have today for hell. So that's super interesting, right? Right out of the gate, there were no concepts of this. But then something changed. Something really, really important changed. So I keep talking about Proto-Judaism, this pre-state of Judaism that predates the time of exile, which is a monumental part of Jewish history, where the Babylonian Empire, if you're not familiar with the story, at this point in Israel's history, after King David and King Solomon and all of his lineage, there's all these different kings, the kingdom, which was once all of Israel, gets divided into two types of kingdoms, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. And in the northern kingdom, it was called Israel. And the southern kingdom, they were neighbors, where it was called Judah. And these two kingdoms had two kings that reigned and ruled. And eventually, the big bad empire, the Assyrian Empire, that was at the head of ruling the known world at that time, came down and conquered the northern kingdom, Israel, and conquered them and wiped them out and exported all those who lived in that kingdom of Israel as slaves. And exported them out throughout the rest of the known world. And we don't hear anything about them for the rest of history. They're just wiped out. They're gone. But then there was this southern kingdom called Judah. So Assyria is kind of in rule. But then the neighbor to Assyria, Babylon, they come to power and they conquer Assyria. And then they eventually move into Judah to conquer Judah. And which included Jerusalem. And when King Nebuchadnezzar goes into Jerusalem, he destroys the temple, wipes everyone out, and exports all the smartest and best Israelites into Babylon as slaves to incorporate them into their Babylonian empire. And then they left a remnant behind in the destroyed Jerusalem. So that history is really important. Because what happened from that is that Israelites began to write their history through the narrative of their experience. And all of a sudden, for the first time in Jewish literature, you begin to hear certain words and certain ideas and concepts begin to pop up for the very first time. So what was first thought about Sheol begins to adapt and grow based off of the experience of their exile. And here's how this kind of works out. If you are, if you have a identity, a national identity, and all of that is taken from you, and you begin to wonder, we thought we were God's people. What happened? Why are we in this place? What has gone wrong? And what is God going to do about it? And so you have all this language and conversation about God's judgment, how God is going to judge the unrighteous. And for the Israelite, it was sometimes themselves and most oftentimes talked about the Babylon Empire and the empires that come after them. And so the post-exile Jews began to reimagine what God was up to in light of the experience that they just had. And so you have all these prophets, Isaiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, who begin to utilize certain kinds of language and talk that is new to the concept of after death and what's going to happen after death. And so what we have is this idea of resurrection and post-mortem judgment. So these two concepts begin to emerge in Jewish thought. Resurrection, post-mortem judgment. These were new concepts in Judaism that did not exist in proto-Judaism. And so what we see in some of these ideas is that God's going to raise the dead and judge the nations. The wicked will face destruction, shame, exclusion, and a term, Gehenna, begins to emerge. Now, what is Gehenna? Gehenna is the Hellenized transliteration of the Valley of Hinnom. Okay, what that means is that the Valley of Hinnom, which is talked about in the by the prophets is a place of judgment, is in Greek is Gehenna. The Hellenized version of the Valley of Hinnom. And so this idea of Gehenna begins to creep into the imagination of Israelites. And this is really important when we get to the New Testament. And we'll get there in a second. But there's some key verses that pop out. So this idea of resurrection and hope. So if you're an exiled people that have been conquered, what do you have? If death is it, then it's it. And then just that life sucks. But yet the Jewish people began to reimagine the hope that God was actually going to do something great and mighty. And so the concept of resurrection began to emerge in the thought of the Jewish people. Not all the Jewish people. And this isn't universal. There were sects and communities that began to emerge that would wrestle with concepts like what Daniel writes about in chapter 12, verse 2, when he says, many of those who sleep in the dusty ground will awake, some to everlasting life, and others to shame and everlasting abhorrence. So it's this idea of now judgment, right? Coming back alive and then being judged for the things that you did on this earth. This is where these ideas begin to creep up in the biblical narrative later on in the second era of the biblical history. You have Jeremiah chapter 7, 31 and 32, where you get the Valley of Hinnom, Gehenna, being talked about. It says, they have built the high places of Topheth in the valley of Ben-Hinnom. And so this is the idea of Gehenna, and it's associated with slaughter, with death. This is an area where child sacrifice took place. This is a place of fire. This is like the worst kind of place. And so in the Jewish imagination, when they are thinking of how God's going to deal with their enemies, they of course think of the worst possible place, the Valley of Hinnom, Gehenna. And so you have this idea, it says this later on in verse 32 of Jeremiah chapter 7. So watch out. The time will soon come when people will no longer call it Topheth or the Valley of Ben-Hinnom. They'll call it the Valley of Slaughter. So it's a place of judgment that God's going to enact his judgment on the evil and the wicked of the world. You have this concept of God's final judgment, this final act where God is going to judge the wicked and those who have gone against his decrees. Isaiah chapter 66, verse 24, they will go out and observe the corpses of those who rebelled against me, for the maggots will eat them and will not die. The fire that consumes them will not die out. It's this idea of final judgment that Jesus actually begins to latch onto in a lot of the ways that he talks about this concept of what we call hell. We'll get into that in a minute. By the post-exile prophetic writings, as the Jewish people are beginning to reimagine what's happening, Sheol begins to split conceptually into two different destinies. The righteous raised to life, the wicked to shame or to hell. This idea of shame, or what we might call hell, was still not a fiery underworld at this time. It was more like divine judgment and destruction outside of God's kingdom. Judgment and destruction is not synonymous with everlasting torment, punishment, and fire. Okay, those ideas and imageries come much later. And just at this point in time, Sheol and this idea of judgment begin to get separated out, and new ideas and thoughts begin to creep up into the imagination of followers of Yahweh at this time, in light of trying to understand the destruction and devastation that they just experienced. So that's era two, post-exile. That leads up into, and that conversation continues into, the third era of biblical history, which is Jesus in the New Testament. And so this is where all of a sudden you get this idea of Gehenna becoming a symbol of judgment. So when Jesus speaks of hell, and when you read in your English translations the word hell, and Jesus using the word hell, the Hebrew word there is Gehenna. The Hellenized, the Greek word is Gehenna that he's using. And we'll get into why we have the word hell and why Jesus would have used the word Gehenna here in a second. There are some exception that Jesus, in Luke's gospel, he'll use the word Hades, which is a Greek idea of the underworld. And the reason why that word Hades is used in correlation to like the story that Luke tells is an exception. It's not the rule. More often than not, Jesus is saying Gehenna every time that we read the word hell. And this is important for us to remember, because Jesus is not writing abstract, or Jesus didn't write anything that we have. Jesus is not speaking an abstract, future-telling language. He is steeped deeply and rooted deeply in his historical context. He's using words that were familiar to the people that would have been around when he was speaking it. And that's important to remember, because words, we don't just use words that nobody knows. That's not how communication works. When we're talking to someone, we're going to use words that are familiar, that are steeped in our culture and our identity. We just don't say things that people don't understand, because that's not how communication works. So Jesus is using the same words, and he's riffing off the same ideas that would have been familiar to his audience. And so in Matthew chapter 5, verse 22, he says, whoever says, you fool, will be sent to the fiery Gehenna. Or maybe your translation says hell, sent to the fiery hell. He's saying the word Gehenna. And remember, in Jewish thought, Gehenna was about judgment. So in this text, he's not saying if you say you fool or speak judge or speak evil against your brother, you know, that's equating to you spending eternal fiery torment forever. He's saying, no, you will be at risk of actually being judged by God. Like, God will look at that act and hold you accountable to that act. It's very different than eternal forever fiery torment. We're not there. Gehenna is a symbolic and divine judgment of evil. It's God saying, this is right, this is wrong, and one day I'm going to do away with wrong. I'm going to do away with evil. And we'll see that in a second in Revelation. But in Matthew chapter 10, 28, again, he echoes the same thing. Do not be afraid of those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Instead, fear the one who is able to destroy both soul and body in, and your English might say hell, but the Hebrew word, if you're reading it in Greek, is Gehenna. It's this concept of judgment, this idea that God is going to hold accountable the evil and the wrongdoing of this world. He's going to make it right. He's going to bring it to good once again. In Mark chapter 9, verse 43 and 48, it is better for you to enter life maimed than to have two hands and go into Gehenna or hell, to the unquenchable fire. Again, it is better that you cut off your hand, right, is what he's saying, or enter life with one eye than for you to actually be under the judgment of the wrongdoing you caused if you had two hands. I hope this makes sense, is that this isn't, Jesus isn't talking about a forever eternal punishment where you're poked by demons and you're in this like punishment for all time. He's saying that it is better for you to go to the extreme, to cut your hand off. And he's not speaking literalistically here. Okay. He's using very strong language to communicate that God takes seriously evil and wrongdoing, that God takes it seriously. And this would not have been new for Jewish thinkers, because this is the trajectory of thought that Jesus is carrying forward here in his teachings. So what we see is this idea of Jesus bringing together this word, this Greek word, Gehenna, to understand the judgment that God's going to bring to those who do evil and wrongdoing. So Jesus's use of Gehenna draws on like Jeremiah's Valley of Slaughter that we talked about, the Valley of Hinnom, and Israel's imagery of a unquenchable fire. These are all symbols of judgment and destruction. So later on, the early followers of Jesus began to pick up on this imagery even further. And so this is the fourth era. So we have proto-Judaism, we have Judaism post-exile, we have Jesus, and we have the later followers of Jesus, these four eras of thought on this conversation, how they all, each era carries it forward just a little bit differently, as you've been hopefully picking up by now. So in Revelation, and let me back up to say this. When we get to the time of the followers of Jesus, we are now infusing not simply Jewish thought, but because of all the Gentiles that are coming into, the Greeks that are coming into Christianity, you're now infusing new thoughts and new words that are coming together and coalescing into a way of thinking about this form of death. And so after Jesus, you have words now like Hades that is being introduced, because we're having more Greek-speaking people that are more prominent in the church. And so these ideas are creeping in. And then remember, the Greek is just the underworld. Hades is more like Sheol than any other kind of concept that we think of like an eternal, forever, fiery judgment. And so you have Hades and you have Gehenna that are beginning to merge in the Christian imagination. So the Jewish way of thinking of judgment in Gehenna, the Valley of Hinnom, and Hades, the underworld, are starting to merge together in Christian thought. Do you see it? This idea of like under and judgment, these themes are creeping into Christian thought. And so you get in like Revelation chapter 20, verse 13 and 14, it says the sea gave up the dead that were in it, and death and Hades gave up the dead that were in them. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. And so you get these words of death, of like this final judgment, and Hades, this like resting place, all of that is done away with. What is John reflecting on here as he writes this? He's talking about the finality, the end of a death where we experience death, and this would echo back into like Genesis chapter 3 that we can get into, you know, when God said to the first humans, don't eat of this tree, for the day of you eat of it, you will surely die, right? So death, this concept of death, is a part of the language and imagination, and John the Revelator here is a saying there's coming a point where that first, if you eat this, you'll surely die. That will be done away with. This concept of death in the grave and death as an experience of humans will go away. And then if you get into Revelation 21, you get into like the new heavens, new earth, eternity. Like this is where we get into the concept of a little bit of heaven. So these ideas begin to come into the imagination of early Christians. I want to turn to one other piece of thought in regards to this, because I'm sure your brain, if it's not already, is melting a little bit, and it maybe, hopefully I've sparked some questions. Hopefully at this point you're going, yeah, but. I hope you are. I hope you're going, yeah, but Joe, what about this verse? What about that verse? And that's exactly what these videos ought to do, is create a space of for you to begin to unlock a portion of your brain to ask a better question, right? So you get this concept of eternal damnation, this like judgment and fire. When you remember in the writing Thessalonians, it's a writing that Paul gives to a church in Thessalonica in the late first century. And it's written under a certain context that's really important, because we miss it. Sometimes when we read just a Bible verse, we miss the whole surrounding that's happening around it. And I know I've probably gone going so long again, and this is what we're going to do here. So I hope you're still with me. But you get these words like this in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1. Verse 8, it says this: with flaming fire, he will mete out punishment on those who do not know God and do not obey the gospel of our Lord Jesus. They will undergo the penalty of eternal destruction away from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of his strength. And so we take that and we go, yes, that's what's going to happen at the end. Evildoers are going to get punished forever. What is the context that Paul writes this? This is important. And it's not to say that this verse isn't true, but I want to frame it a little bit for you. So at this time, it is believed that this community of Jesus followers has been experiencing some form of persecution, and even up to death, that some in their community have died for the faithful following of Jesus. And Paul is presumably writing to them to encourage them about the devastation to their community that they've experienced. Not unlike how the early prophets and those after the prophets, like in the writings, the intertestamental writings of lots of different writings that happened that time to get into, like the Book of Enoch and others like it, that are these like apocryphal type of writings that talk a lot about destruction and judgment. It's not unlike that, where Paul here is trying to write with certain language and vivid description to bring about encouragement and hope for those who are experiencing this kind of devastation. So again, put your brain to where, like, remember, imagine what it would have felt like for someone that has been exiled out of their home. Their homeland has been destroyed by war, and now they're living in a foreign country, and they're asking the question, God, what are you going to do about that? I imagine, and my hypothesis is that this is the undercurrent of what Paul's trying to do here in this writing. And so if you look in verse 5, before the verse 8 that we read, it goes like this. This is evidence of God's righteousness judgment, to make you worthy of the kingdom of God, for which in fact you are suffering. So he's saying, hey, I want to make sure you understand the worthiness of your adherence to God, even though you're in the midst of suffering. And he says, for it is right for God to repay with affliction those who afflict you, and to you who are being afflicted to give rest together with us when the Lord Jesus revealed from heaven with his mighty angels. With flaming fire, he will mete out punishment on those. And the verse goes on as we just read it. In verse 10, when he comes to be glorified among his saints and admired on that day among all who have been believed, and you did in fact believe our testimony. So he, in this passage, is trying to encourage them by using the same kind of language that would have been used by the prophets before him. That's not to say it's untrue. Hear me out, okay? There's an element of Jesus talks about God's judgment. The prophets talk about God's judgment. Paul talks about God's judgment. But God's judgment is not synonymous with eternal punishment. It simply means that God will do something about, make a decisive judgment about the evil that is existing in the world. That is the hope that we have as believers in Yahweh and Jesus as God, that one day evil will be done away with. And our hope is that God is not ignorant or unaware of the plight of evil in our world. And the hope is that God will do something about that. Now, what does that mean about where I go when I die? That was our opening question. The answer to that question, for me, is that this concept of Sheol is not untrue. It has a ring of truth, as the proto-Judaism understood it. The concept of judgment, as post-exile began to imagine, is not untrue. Resurrection is not untrue. Jesus resurrected. That gives us our hope in our own resurrection. In 1 Corinthians 15, Paul echoes that same hope in what we can look forward to in resurrection. All of these things are true. And so what happens when I die, and what will hell be like? That I'm just not sure the Bible's very clear on. And so I leave that to you as you begin to wrestle with this concept of hell. I want to, in my conclusion here, draw out one last thing. So to review, right, you have pre-exile Israel, which is proto-Judaism. Sheol is the concept. You have the exile in the Second Temple Judaism, that is Sheol and Gehenna. Jesus talks about Gehenna. Early Christians talked about Hades and Gehenna. In our modern concept that we have today, we use the word hell. So where does the word hell come from, and why is it so prominent in our Bibles? Well, that's an interesting, if there's so many concepts of you know, Sheol, Gehenna, Hades, why is there one word to summarize them all? And here's an interesting point in translation history. So as you can see, the original languages from Greek, Gehenna, to Hebrew, Valley of Hinnom, from Hebrew, Sheol, to Greek, Hades, these ideas, this Greek and Hebrew, is the original languages that these things were written in. So what happened was that as time went on, as Alexander the Great conquered the known world, everywhere that he conquered, he required people to speak one language, Greek. And so Greek became the world's language. And so as Hebrew began to die off, it is believed that at some point, maybe in Alexandria, that the Hebrew Bible, to preserve it, was translated into Greek, which became known as the Septuagint. So it was a Greek version of the Bible. And so when you start seeing this word of like Gehenna, it's because of the Septuagint. It's the Greek version of the Hebrew Bible. And that's actually the version of the Bible, the Septuagint, that Jesus read. The Septuagint was so popular, it was produced out and it went into different synagogues. And so if you had a scroll in a certain synagogue, you most likely had a Greek version of that scroll. And so Jesus uses the word Gehenna because that would have been the version of Bible he read, the Septuagint. And so he just carried that forward. And it would have been what the New Testament authors who are retelling us what Jesus said, that's the word they would have used because that's the version of the Bible they would have been familiar with, the Greek version. So what happened is that you have all of these concepts of hell as we think about it. But what happened was that later on in church history, there was a guy named Jerome. And Jerome, he actually translated the Bible from Greek into Latin. And when Jerome got to the places that it mentions like Gehenna or Sheol, he simply used one Latin word to translate those different topics. And so as time went on, when it went from Latin and then you get to the King James Version, you get the translation in like from the Germanic languages into English. They took the Latin word that was used everywhere in the Bible that Jerome translated into, that's where you get the word hell. And so that carried forward that when we see so many instances of the word hell, we need to do the work because are we talking about Gehenna? Are we talking about Sheol? What are we talking about? Now, some of your more modern Bibles will help you with this. They'll put footnotes at the bottom. They're very aware. Scholars are very aware that Jerome just used one word to translate different concepts and ideas, and that the King James, which is a translation from the Latin Vulgate, did the same thing, just carried it forward, and that we lost some of the nuance of what this word means because of our English translation. And again, some of your modern Bibles will actually fix that for you in some places, or put a footnote at the bottom somewhere, if you look hard enough, that tells you that the word there is Gehenna, or the word there is Sheol, so that you understand maybe the nuance difference. But if you don't know what Sheol is, and you don't know what Gehenna is, you run the risk of misunderstanding what the sentence is that you're reading in English. And that's why these things are so important, is because when we want to get to the bottom of what hell is, we actually need to understand how we got to the word hell, which is a King James Version. And how did they get to the word hell? Came from the Latin Vulgate with Jerome in the 4th century. And why did he choose the word that he used to mean one word? It's because he was probably just trying to simplify a concept. Like, it's kind of hard to tell. And maybe there's a scholar out there that's not, I'm not a Jerome scholar, so I'm not sure why he chose the one word to represent the many ideas of hell in Jewish and New Testament literature, but he did. And before that, it was an idea that had different concepts. And so this is what I want to encourage you with as we wrap up. And this has been a long video. I'm like sweating, right? Hopefully this has been helpful and interesting. Let me encourage you with this. One, the idea that hell is a fiery place where you're going to burn forever and be tortured if you don't do the right things for God is a new idea in Christian thought that actually starts, eternal punishment actually starts with a writer named Augustine. And I don't particularly agree with forever eternal punishment. I don't see that in the Bible. I actually see how Augustine introduced that concept into the modern thought of Western Christians that have stayed with us for generations now. And I just wonder, as great as Augustine was, a brilliant, great thinker, that's not to undercut what he talked about, but in his writing, City of God, he introduces this concept of eternal torment and punishment. And all I'm saying, whether he's right or wrong, okay, I don't personally believe that that's the way of Jesus and the way of the Bible. I don't. I could be wrong, right? I could be wrong. But I just want to offer you this reality that that concept was introduced much later into Christian thought. And I don't believe can be traced faithfully back to the actual Jesus and God and who God is and his character and his nature. That's my two cents. I want to encourage you to do the work on your own, to research, to read, to think, to look into these ideas and concepts and see where it leads you. I'd love to hear in your comments or send me an email if you have a question or a thought that you want me to explore further. For that, I've been talking long enough and we've been going quite some time. I'm sweaty and ready to be done. Thank you for listening. Thank you for suggesting that I do this video and like, subscribe if it's something that is meaningful to you. That being said, cheers. We'll see you next time.